Gospel of Mark is this simple message establishing Christ as the Messiah, the secret, the mystery that is being progressively revealed, and various people are responding in various ways, mostly poorly, but some hearing, some seeing. To review a little bit, in the last portion that we looked at 2 weeks ago, we saw that Jesus was demonstrating to the disciples that his kingdom was not only for Jews, but that it was for Gentiles as well. And so he traveled outside some of the Judean regions, and he went far up to the northwest, Tyre and Sidon, and there a Gentile woman showed her faith, a Syrophoenician woman by birth. And Jesus said to her, "Let the children be filled first, for it is not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the little dogs." And she responded with great faith, "Yes, Lord, but even the little dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs. Surely the Messiah is for me too. Surely his food is for others to eat." And he said, "For this saying, go your way." And he healed her daughter. And then he departed from the northwest region down to the southeast, to the region of Decapolis, to the Sea of Galilee. And there was a deaf and mute man that he healed, there demonstrating and showing a portrait of the kingdom that is to come. That God is able, Jesus is able, to be the king who heals all wounds. He's the one that's able to open eyes and ears and mouths. He has this power and this authority. So while he's still in this region in Decapolis, which is still, remember, the Gentile region, he begins traveling around, it looks like, for 3 days, for a few days. And there's a sort of a repetitive miracle that happens here. It'll look familiar to you as we begin in chapter 8. Let's read 1 through 10. In those days, the multitude being very great and having nothing to eat, Jesus called his disciples to him and said to them, "I have compassion on the multitude because they have now continued with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. And if I send them away hungry to their own houses, they will faint on the way, for some of them have come from afar." Then his disciples answered him, "How can one satisfy these people with bread here in the wilderness?" He asked them, "How many loaves do you have?" And they said, 7. So he commanded the multitude to sit down on the ground, and he took the 7 loaves and gave thanks and broke them and gave them to his disciples to set before them. And they set them before the multitude. They also had a few small fish, and having blessed them, he said to set them also before them. So they ate and were filled, and they took up 7 large baskets of leftover fragments. Now those who had eaten were about 4,000. And he sent them away, immediately got into the boat with his disciples, and came to the region of Dalmanutha. Okay, so in this Gentile region, traveling around teaching, the crowds are great. Even here, they've heard of him, and his fame is growing. He had just healed this deaf-mute man in this region. He told them to not tell anybody in verse 36 of chapter 7, but the more he commanded them, the more widely they proclaimed it, and they were astonished beyond measure, saying, "He has done all things well. He makes both the deaf to hear and the mute to speak." So everyone is hearing about this great healer, and they're following him. He's teaching. Decapolis is a region in the southeast of the Sea of Galilee. So it's not just one city. There's a wide area that he could be traveling in. And so looks like he's probably going around to cities and outside of cities so as not to draw even bigger crowds. And all of these people are with him. Their supplies have been used up in the time that he's been teaching. They've probably ate the food that they packed that day that they set out to follow Jesus. And so they're 3 days in now, and some have traveled. This is another sort of hint at this being for the Gentiles. They've traveled from afar. It's almost like from the east or from these far countries. The nations are now following Jesus in Decapolis. And so before he sends them home, knowing that some of them have a long journey and they've already, not that they've been without food for 3 full days, but their supplies have dwindled and they have nothing left. They certainly have no food for the journey home. He says, "I want to be generous to them, a generous teacher, a kind, host, as it were, of this get-together, and I want to give them food. So not only is this text sort of culminating the exposure of the Word being the kingdom and Jesus the King being for the Gentiles, it's also revealing the faithlessness of the Jews, even the ones very close to him. So when Jesus says, I'd like to be generous to these people, I want to give them food, the disciples answer him, well, how are we going to do that? How could we satisfy these people? Who could satisfy these people with bread here so far away from the city, so far into the wilderness? Well, the ding-dongs, it just happened not that long ago, right? We just did this. And where did we do it? We did it in Judea. We did it with Jewish people. So why the repetition of the miracle? Why does Jesus do this again? For Mark's point, I think primarily, it is to show, it is the demonstration that the kingdom is for Gentiles as well. The feast is for Gentiles as well. The prophesied messianic banquet feast. The king will feed all of the nations. So it's not just something that happened here. Wow, we had 5,000 men over here that then he fed the whole crowds. No, he does the same thing among the nations. But man, the faithlessness of his disciples, it wouldn't be that hard, even if the question were something like, wait, are you going to do it again? Like, are you going to feed them again with nothing? If it were that, you know, that's understandable. But this seems, difficult to comprehend why they would respond the way that they do. And a lot, you know, in reading various commentators, they're all often trying to supply, like, well, here's probably what they were thinking. Here's probably the reason. And I don't know. I think we're supposed to, at this point in Mark, be pretty disappointed with how the disciples are responding. Their response should be far more faith-filled, if nothing else, because of their proximity to Jesus and because they've seen what he not only did once, but what he does, who he is, how he acts. But they say, how could this happen? He doesn't even say, I can. Obviously, he can. That's the demonstration. But he asks them, well, what do we have? How much do we have? 7 loaves. Okay. Everyone sit down. There's so many similarities between this account and the one before. Not identical, but nigh unto it. So in this case, he starts just with bread, but you've come to find out there's also fish. So some bread and some fish. And you have the same almost, I mean, does the language not remind you of anything else? When he sits everybody down and they're at this big banquet and then Jesus gives thanks and he breaks the bread and he sets it before the disciples. Like between the last miracle and this miracle and the feeding of the many thousands, there is an anticipation of what we read later in Mark and in the other Gospels and in 1 Corinthians 11 of the last Passover feast. It's a very similar motion to the Last Supper. So in this case, I think it does several things. It looks back for the Jews to Jesus' ability to provide food in the wilderness. You look back to sort of wandering Israel and say, where will we eat? How will we be sustained? And Jesus says, if you're looking backward and you're reading the scriptures, you know the stories, I can provide bread for you. For the reader today, like one of us, I think it takes us back to communion, to the bread and the cup as a remembrance of his great ability to provide salvation through himself. And then for the Jews at the time and for us as well, it is anticipation of this great feast, of the Messianic banquet. He will provide not just enough, but even like some of the Thanksgiving tonight, he provides far more than we need. And that's exactly what happens here. So after everyone has eaten all the bread that they want, all of the fish that they want, everybody's full, what do they have? Well, similar to what they had before, they have leftovers. So in the Jewish account, there were 12 baskets of leftovers. If we're leaning into anything, it probably is. That's a very Jewish number. It's a very number around like the 12 tribes or Jesus' 12 disciples. That makes sense that it's sort of represented there. And then 7 here. There are 7 baskets here. Nothing explicitly Gentile about that. But we do know that the Hebrews use 7 to communicate fullness and completion. So not only are the people full, but the intention of the feast proclamation is sort of full. Like, it's not only here, but it's also there. So like a full feast for the nations. And having completed this circuit of teaching for these several days in Decapolis, he then sends the people home, gets into the boat with his disciples, and comes to the region of Dalmanutha. Now, where's Dalmanutha? This is one of the ones that we're a little bit less certain where it is. Now, there's a very brief account that follows it where the Pharisees come out at Dalmanutha to interact with him. So that would clue us in, if nothing else, that it's probably the western side of the Sea of Galilee, which would have been the side where the Jews were living and where they would have had Pharisees ready and waiting for Jesus. So it's probably on the western side. There's a couple different cities and some digs that have been done Dalmanutha, but we're not 100% sure, to my understanding, where this city is. So a really brief account, just 2 verses in, as it's marked out for us here. Why does this exist? The Pharisees come out and they start to argue with Jesus again, right as soon as he gets there, it seems. They're just, oh yes, and another thing, they want from him a sign from heaven. They're testing him. But he sighed deeply in his spirit, and he said, why does this generation seek a sign? Assuredly, I say to you, no sign shall be given to this generation. And then he left them and got into the boat and departed to the other side. So what's going on here? Why does this exist? Well, for a few reasons. One, it continues to establish and set up the great controversy between Jesus and the religious leaders. It's another brief account in that whole storybook, leading to the sort of great battle at the end where they oppose him and lead the people to chant, crucify him, and lead him to the cross. So the leaders are still against him, but it also is introduction to Jesus' teaching in the boat. So it really sets up, if we didn't have these couple verses here, we wouldn't know why Jesus has the conversation that he does with the disciples in the boat. So those are a few reasons. But what is the spirit of the Pharisees here? They want, again, increased authentication of his divinity. I don't think it's that they've forgotten what they've seen. They know what they've seen. They know what he can do. They know that he can do miracles. They know that he can heal. But they want more. Maybe not another of the same, but something bigger. Something like, I don't know, put a star in the sky. I don't know, you know, like something grand that they can, an undeniable tying of Jesus to God the Father. And Jesus is righteously frustrated because everything that he has given them, everything that he has shown them, should be far more than abundant to prompt faith. There are other times he says, if I did what I've done here out in the world, the whole world would have believed on me. All of the people who didn't have the commandments of God, all of the people who had never heard from Yahweh, all of the people who had never read the book of Moses, they would all look at this and say, wow, we should follow this teacher, he's from God. And here you don't. Here, the religious elite, the people who know the scriptures the best, they reject me. They want more. And so, in his righteous indignation, he says, no, this generation will not receive a sign. Not what they were asking for. They've been given enough. And so he leaves. And we get to the third of the Markan boat accounts. And in none of the three have the disciples fared very well. Right? In each of them, their kind of faithlessness is exposed. And here, it's exposed in a little bit different way. Not because of a great storm, but because of their blindness, of the fact that they are not seeing what he is intending to show them. So he leaves. He gets into the boat again, verse 13, and departs to the other side. Now, the disciples had forgotten to take bread, and they did not have more than 1 loaf with them in the boat. Can't you already sort of see that it's a setup for failure for the disciples? It's about a minimal amount of bread again. They haven't been doing very well with the minimal accounts of bread. And they then he charges them, verse 15, saying, "Take heed, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod." Another bread reference. And they reason among themselves, saying, "It's because we don't have bread." But Jesus, being aware of it, I mean, it's just a boat, right? He could hear them, says to them, "Why do you reason because you have no bread? Do you not yet perceive nor understand? Is your heart still hardened? Having eyes, do you not see? And having ears, do you not hear? Do you not remember when I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000, how many baskets full of fragments did you take up?" They said to him, 12. "And also, when I broke the 7 for the 4,000, how many large baskets full of fragments did you take up?" And they said, 7. So he said to them, "How is it that you don't understand?" It's almost another feeding of the 5,000 error, isn't it? So this situation is immediately following the conversation with the Pharisees, and that's what Jesus is teaching them about. He's saying, beware lest you are like them, like the ones we just discussed, like, or had a conversation with. The leaven of the Pharisees, the leaven of Herod. Now, the leaven is like this piece of the dough that you would leave out, you then mix into the new dough that you're making, and the new dough rises because there's yeast in the previous part. And a little leaven is effective. A little leaven leavens the whole lump. It doesn't take a lot to be effective. And it's often associated, particularly for the Jews, and these boys, like they know that the picture of leaven, particularly in their feasts, is often a negative thing. It's often identified with sin, something that has almost a disease kind of an effect. And so he says, don't be diseased like the Pharisees. Don't have like gangrene like them or like Herod. He's talking about the leaders. He's talking about the ones that have opposed him. And he's saying, look, how are they responding to me? Well, with blindness and trying to sort of poison the well, trying to lead people away from me, constantly questioning, never receiving, always wondering, always another question, always wanting another sign. He says, instead it would be better if they would just open their eyes, if they would open their ears, if they would receive, if they would hear. That's what would be better. It's to see what I'm seeking to show you. But when he says that, don't be like the leaders, they're so concerned with the error that they know they've made, which we often do, right? If you know you've misstepped, and then somebody comes to maybe address something with you, and you're like, oh no, it's because they know about the thing. Oh no, it's because they know what I did do or what I didn't do, or that I forgot to bring the this. Or that's exactly where they're at. That's where their mind's at. They're sort of preoccupied with their error. And yet, I think they also, and this is not maybe gracious, but I think they also perceive themselves wise to have understood his riddle, to have understood his teaching, his parable. They're like, oh, the leaven of the Pharisees, he's giving us a hint about the bread. We know, we have eyes to see what he's trying to say, that we've made this error. And I don't know, maybe it's because they keep running out of food in various places, so he might have told them, bring a little bit more food, guys, you know? And then they just bring one loaf, which is not enough for anybody. I don't know where those 7 baskets went, if they gave them out, or they ate them all on the way back, or they just left them on the shore, or what, but they're somewhere, not in the boat. And so they think, yeah, it's because we forgot the bread. Jesus responds, here again, I'm thinking Proverbs, I'm thinking parenting, thinking teaching. Jesus uses all different kinds of teaching and instruction tools. We are quite free to instruct in a wide variety of ways. So does Jesus teach the same way every time? No, he doesn't. In fact, he throws people off, sometimes intentionally, to sort of teach them in a menagerie of ways. So here, he does what? He only asks questions. He asks 8 questions. That's the entire content of the teaching that we have recorded anyways. So questions, rhetorical, ones that are also intended to be answered, ones that are repetitive. You notice that he sort of flanks the two questions. It's the number two is, do you not yet perceive or understand? And then the last one in verse 21 is, how is it you don't understand? So you ask the same question at the beginning and the same question at the end. Five questions here. Why do you reason because you have no bread? Why are you doing what you're doing? Why are you saying what you're saying and thinking what you're thinking? Do you not perceive or understand? Clearly, they know at this point, even two questions in, that they missed it. They missed his intention. Is your heart still hardened? Oh, no. It's my fault that I didn't get it. You know, I've missed something. It's not that the teacher's in error. It's that the student is in error. Student is missing the point. And then he says, having eyes, do you not see? Having ears, do you not hear? They know that this is important for them. They know that he speaks parabolically, often to sort of shroud things in a bit of mystery so that people who don't have spiritual understanding will miss it. And now he's asking them, are you also one of these? Are the 12 closest to me also ones who don't have any spiritual understanding, who lack insight into my teaching? And you don't remember. Remember what? Well, exactly what he's about to say, the last two accounts. So he's, and if you're ever wondering, there are some that have wondered if, you know, this recounting of the miracle is just a reiteration of the first one, like meaning the story, the same story told again. And that's certainly undone here, if that ever comes up in your study or in questions maybe from other people. So he says in verse 19, this is what they were supposed to remember. He says, okay, guys, when we were back, right? Miracle number one, we were in that field, everybody was hungry, back with the Jews. When I broke the five loaves for the 5,000, how many baskets full of fragments did you take up? 12. Okay, that's right. Also, remember like 2 days ago when we were over in the Gentile region? It did the same thing, right? I broke the 7 for the 4,000. How many large baskets full of fragments did you take up? 7. Then he said, so how is it you don't understand? Now, has he explained what he meant the first time? No. Did he explain what he meant about the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod? Not a bit. All he did was undo their answer. There's an interesting teaching tactic, isn't it? He didn't actually say, no, let me tell you. Wrong answer, this is the right answer. One tactic in teaching, in parenting, is, no, think about it some more. Here, let me lead you by a series of questions to show you how you've reached the wrong conclusion and let you sit on it. So, what was their conclusion? Bread's the problem. We forgot the bread. So in his reminding them of these things, what is he showing them? Is the problem that I can't take care of the bread? Is that the issue? You have a couple really, really good things, like really good recent memories that should be sure to lead you away from the conclusion that the problem is Jesus doesn't have enough bread. Jesus always has enough bread. He can make bread. He could do that anytime that he wants to. So he's not telling them, he's not warning them about this sort of thing. His concern is not a physical concern. His concern is not food. No, that's not the leaven of the Pharisees. Guys, I'm not cluing you in with some like word association of leaven. I'm cluing you into the conversation we just had with the Pharisees and their blindness. The fact that they are oppressing and affecting the people and their response to truth by constantly criticizing, constantly questioning, never welcoming the true teacher. So, just to establish all of this, we'll make it through verse 30 tonight. So, there's two more quick accounts. They get to Bethsaida, which is on sort of the north, slightly east, the northeast part. So, they're just sort of bouncing all over the Sea of Galilee in this boat, aren't they? So they get up north, and right when they get here, there's a blind man that people are begging for Jesus to heal. A little bit of an interesting scenario again. Let's read through it. 22 and following. So they came to Bethsaida, they brought a blind man to him, begged him to touch him. So he took the blind man by the hand, led him out of town. And when he had spit on his eyes and put his hands on him, he asked him if he saw anything. And he looked up and said, I see men like trees walking. And then he put his hands on his eyes again and made him look up. And then he was restored and saw everyone clearly. Then Jesus sent him away to his house, saying, neither go into the town nor tell anyone in the town. So in this case, we'll see in a moment, Jesus is sort of en route to Caesarea Philippi. He has a 25-mile walk that he wants to take with the disciples up to this region. Likely because that's where the transfiguration happens. There's a mountain up there. But he's around or in, I guess, immediately. He's in town. They bring this guy to him. He takes the guy out of town to do the healing, probably to keep it quiet, and then takes off from there. So what's really unique as far as this story goes is the fact that it's like a two-part healing. Now, this man's blind, and Jesus does some work. Jesus takes a first swing at it, and it's a he can kind of see. It's like he opens his eyes for the first time after the great miracle worker has worked on him, and it's like, well, it's better. You know? I can see shapes, sorta. I can see fuzzy people walking around. Thank you, you know? I'll take it. Jesus takes another swing at it, and then he opens his eyes and he can see clearly. Why is that happening? What in the world is going on? Was it like that difficult of a demon, you know? That hard of a thing to fix? No, certainly not. Is it that Jesus sort of slipped or something? Missed a little? No. Jesus is teaching something completely unrelated to the blind man that really only takes great life in the literary, like, story of Mark. Because Mark has seen Jesus' intention here, and he tells the story in a way that just fits, like puzzle pieces, to what's happened before and what's about to happen next. Because Jesus doesn't need two tries to heal a blind man, does he? Why did he do that? He did that to teach the disciples concerning themselves. He did that to teach the disciples that they are like phase one of Jesus having healed this blind man. They kind of see. As revealed by what Peter does in a moment, right? As revealed by the fact that they're with him and faithful to him and they left the boats and they're doing all these things and they forget that he can do miracles. They forget that he's a provider. They're concerned with physical things. They're not catching his cues. They're not really in harmony with Jesus's teaching. They know some things and they see some things, but it's pretty blurry right now. That's the literary point that Mark is making. And what Jesus is intending to teach the disciples is like, oh, I think I need more sight. I think I need round two of Jesus healing the blind man so that I will see clearly. But Jesus sends this man back into town, and then he goes on a 25-mile walk with the boys. Now, notice, isn't it interesting that Jesus kind of uses these opportunities to teach as well? So, again, as people who teach other people, parents, teachers, mentoring, discipling, we don't always have to cultivate the perfect setting to have instruction. In fact, we don't always have to cultivate a conversation to have good instruction. A lot of what Jesus is doing is, to use a phrase that was used up at the first school I went to, Northland, is that this is sort of life on life. There is a lot of just interaction that happens along the way. Jesus uses road trips. He uses time in the boat and time on the road, time while they're hiking. Sort of think back on conversations that he knows they've been privy to think on things that he's intending to teach them, and to use a wide variety of strategies to perhaps lead them into truth. Now, we're also operating with a lot less information than Jesus was, and we'll be far less skilled, yet we learn from him. So Jesus uses this walk. Now Jesus and his disciples, verse 27, went out to the towns of Caesarea Philippi, and on the road he asks his disciples, saying to them, "Who do men say that I am?" So they're like, "Oh, well, John the Baptist. I heard somebody say Elijah, one of the prophets." And he says to them, "All right, what do you guys think? Who do you say that I am?" Peter pipes up. He answers and says to him, "You are the Christ." And he strictly warned them that they should tell no one about him. This is the turning point of the book. This is where things begin to pivot. And so in this conversation, it's fascinating that when he asks them what other people are saying, like, what are you sort of hearing? What are the conversations that, you know, when you're around in town, when you're going to get food, when people are asking you questions, what are they thinking? And they're thinking, well, somebody great, you know, a great teacher, John the Baptist, Elijah, like these are premier Old Testament guys, Elijah is, and John the Baptist, premier New Testament guy. One of the prophets, there's a connection even between Elijah and John. Somebody great. And what's interesting is that as we think about this 2,000 years later, that's what almost everybody says, right? Even most world religions view Jesus positively, view him as some sort of great teacher, maybe a prophet, maybe someone even sent from God, certainly a moral individual who had good societal principles, things that would lead us into like a society of kindness and things like that. But is that enough? Is that who he really is? Is that all that our Jesus, our King, our Savior is? No, it's not. And so Peter looks really good in his answer, doesn't he? You might even say, is that like the blinders coming off? Is this phase two? Does he now see clearly? He says, "You are the Christ." We just read even in Hebrews, didn't we? That this is like the identification of Jesus. He's the Christ. He's been the Messiah from before time unto today and to forever. Like this is who he is. This is the Old Testament character that's been prophesied. It's the anointed one. It's the one that's going to save Israel from their sins. It's the one that's going to deliver them. It's the one that's going to bring back the Davidic kingdom. He's all of these things, many, many, even hundreds of prophecies about this one. And so Peter's like, "You're that guy. You are the Hebrew is Mashiach. You're the prophesied anointed one. In the Greek, you're the Christos." And so he's right. He nails it. But he sees through a veil. What happens, and we'll just read the next piece. What happens immediately after this is Jesus like, "You're right. I want you to keep this amongst yourselves right now. And I'm going to start to teach you about who the Christ is, about what that means." And so he starts to explain. He teaches them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed. And after 3 days, rise again. He starts to really show what's behind the curtain, to show them how the story is going to unfold and what he's going to do, what his mission here is. He spoke this word openly. Then Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But when he had turned around and looked at the disciples, he rebuked Peter, saying, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are not mindful of the things of God, but the things of men." Isn't that a pretty clear illustration that Peter can see, but he sees like walking trees, like men, like trees walking? It's pretty fuzzy. And so what Jesus does in the texts that follow is he begins teaching his disciples about the cross. He begins teaching them about what he's going to do. There are three different cycles. We'll see this as we go through. It's interspersed with some other stories, but there's three different teaching times where Jesus rehearses this prediction about his death and what's going to happen explicitly in Jerusalem. And then the fact that there's a misunderstanding. The disciples don't quite get it. Peter didn't quite get it. They still like bicker and argue or push back or misunderstand, see very in a very veiled way. And then he leads them to see the implication of the cross for them and teaches them about the cost of discipleship and how that's going to be a pretty high cost for them too. So that we're turning the corner into the next phase. But the theme of really this section as a whole, as it leads us to the turning point, is the fact that even the Messianic kingdom, the great feast, is for the nations. And he's a king that's not only able to provide for ethnically his people, but religiously his people. I mean, these are the world is his. And so he will provide a great and varied feast. The people closest to him are still, there's still a rejection. The prophet is, he has no honor in his own country. Even in his closest circle, it's not clicking. And so when he says things, it's just very disjointed. So that they think their great error is forgetting the bread. And they think they forget his great ability to provide bread, his abundance, his spiritual teaching, all of these things. Which exposes to us the need for God to open eyes, as he did with the blind man. So the blind man really is, it's actually at the heart of the whole thing, is that Jesus opens his eyes. And he opens them at times progressively. It's not always an all-at-once sort of a thing. In fact, we know through the process of salvation that we are in a process of our eyes being opened. Even Paul describes, like, this whole life, in one way, is seeing from behind a veil, isn't it? A life of faith is... There's great difficulty and some distance there as it relates to belief. But blessed are those who believe and who have faith, even though they can't see many things. And it's just this promise too, as Jesus demonstrates, but I will give not just veiled sight, I will give clear sight. And that's what he does with the blind man. So I think good encouragements of assurance, encouragements of Jesus' promise towards spiritual progress and his patience with his people in his mission of being the Christ. So he's a faithful teacher, and he will do the same even for us.